think I could breathe. Yeah. Sit down in a fire. And then think I could breathe. Yeah.
CKUT.3 FM.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. What? Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the June 22 edition of No One's Legal Radio. We're part of No Borders Media and the CKUT Communities Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. On today's No One's Legal Radio, we feature an interview with labor and migrant justice organizer and member of the Immigrant Workers Center, Mustafa Hanawe. Mustafa has written and spoken widely about megacorporation Amazon, which includes his own brief work experience there. On today's hour-long interview, we explore various topics in relation to Amazon, including modern capitalism and logistics, workers' rights, unionization struggles from Alabama to New York City to Montreal, and much more. We'll go to that interview right now. I'm speaking with Mustafa Hanawe. Mustafa is speaking to me from the Immigrant Workers Center in Côte-des-Neiges in Montreal. Mustafa is a labor organizer, a migrant justice organizer, and he's both analyzed and worked at Amazon, which is the main topic of our conversation today and all the implications that arise from analyzing Amazon. Mustafa, welcome again to No Borders Media and No One's Legal Radio.
Thank you, Jaggy, for having me on and like such a timely topic.
Absolutely. It's timely, I guess, for a lot of reasons. People are talking about Amazon's profits all the time. They seem to have done quite well out of the pandemic. The model of capitalism that Amazon represents, and of course, workers who are demanding some level of justice and dignity through unionization drives and other methods as well, of course. So hopefully we'll have time to get into most of that. Maybe we can start off by just, if you can talk about why we should care about Amazon. Why does Amazon and the so-called Amazon model matter to everyday people and to, you know, to our movements in general?
Well, I mean, Amazon, I think, matters significantly, right? And it represents a kind of a drastic shift. Not just about a question of labor, which absolutely, which I'll get into, but also signifies sort of this drastic shift where before the power in capitalism was the actual producers of commodities, right? Like the, you know, when you think about large corporations like Nike or Adidas, and now the real shift in terms of power and capitalism is not just these large tech giants, which Amazon is part of, but also fundamentally these corporations that are engaged in logistics or in the distribution of goods, right? But you can also think about a lot of other companies that fit within that aren't, you know, considered traditionally that, right? So Walmart is another example. Walmart is a distribution company, right? It doesn't produce anything. It simply circulates and distributes those goods. But because it has so much control over its market and the market share, it dictates the conditions across its supply chains, right? So it has drastic effects in terms of a race to a bottom, not just in, you know, let's say advanced capitalist economies in the global north, but right through to the global south, right, where these goods are actually produced, right? And the same goes for Amazon, right? And Amazon is sort of this evolution of Walmart, right? And a lot of people, when they think about Amazon as being sort of this you know, they when they think about the sort of the Elon Musks or the Jeff Bezos, you sort of think about them as sort of these very entrepreneurial individuals. These are sort of the kind of like the highlights or the sort of these glory moments of capitalism or of free markets, right? Like look at what freedom produces, and look under capitalism we get very bright ideas and bright individuals who are able to bring value, right, to our society. But if you look at Amazon is actually the, you know, the mutation or the birth child of sort of globalization, right, of the 90s, right, both the tech revolution, but also, you know, the ways in which that race to the bottom that globalization produced and the offshoring of production, right? And so Amazon is actually this kind of the you know, distorted, it's the Frankenstein of globalization, right? And bringing e-commerce, right? And so, and because Amazon's growth and drastic growth over the last 20 years is changing the way other capitalist corporations also operate, right? So in terms of why Amazon is important, so Amazon always claims that it's sort of the small fish, right, in terms of the world of retail, but actually Amazon controls 50% of e-commerce, right? Amazon in some countries represents 10% of total retail, right? And Amazon gets bigger and bigger. And even for the things that it doesn't directly control, it's trying to control the infrastructure of it, right? And so we see that now with all of the businesses that Amazon's engaged with, right? So if you look at Amazon Web Services, which is the cloud computing services, which has been involved with ICE, facial recognition programs, with police services in the US, you know, is the cloud computing service for the CIA and multiple government agencies around the world. And Amazon Web Services was an internal platform to Amazon's logistics. So if you look at Amazon's e-commerce operations and the ways it's expanded, again, it's being marketized, right? So if you look at recent, people say, well, Amazon's slowing down, we're all going back to normal, we're out of this pandemic mode. Well, Amazon becomes the infrastructure for other companies that require logistics infrastructure or warehousing for them, right? And because companies realize they can't compete with Amazon, they now become reliant upon Amazon. And what does that actually mean, right? So, which is the Amazon model, right? Which is this complete drastic race to the bottom, right? So one, you have this, you know, Amazon is the world's fifth largest private employer, right? 1.5 million workers. While it's still smaller than Walmart, it will soon be the largest private employer in the United States, right? And a lot of that work you begin to see is just going, you know, the conditions of workers inside, you know, Amazon's fulfillment centers becomes more and more precarious, right? People are seasonal workers. People are working 10 hours a day. People are becoming, it's this race to the bottom, where there's this rapid turnover and becomes this race to the bottom, or the way Amazon outsourced a lot of its delivery. So, and then coupled with the kind of surveillance that Amazon uses, you know, a lot of people, when we think about Big Brother, and we think about what's happening in places like China or Xinjiang, and there's all this liberal outcry, right? Amazon uses artificial intelligence cameras and facial recognition inside its workplaces. If it's the United States' largest private employer, that means nearly a million people are subjugated to real-time artificial intelligence Big Brother surveillance for most of their waking days. So you can have this liberal moral outcry around what's happening in China, but it's actually happening in people's backyard. And then because Amazon treats its warehouses like a laboratory, it's then selling that to government agencies, right? And that's what's happening. So the Amazon model is drastically, I mean, it's, it, you know, this, and so it's the only way it can happen, right? This sort of this hyper surveillance, this sort of hyper precarity, this you know, turning workers into meshing technology and labor to squeeze the most out of workers is the only way Amazon can provide one-click shopping, fast and free delivery. And so for everybody else, that becomes the model, right? Because if you're a capitalist, you're not thinking to yourself, I want to be like the guy who's losing. I want to be like Jeff Bezos. So what does that mean? What do you do to your workers, right? And the more everything becomes online, the more then logistics becomes central to capitalism in countries like, you know, the United States or Canada or in Europe, right? So Amazon becomes, it's not just a question about inequality or the gross inequality that Jeff Bezos represents, but it represents a shift in the way capitalists organize work, organize the distribution of goods, organize the production of those goods, and that means that entails the, you know, the world economy.
Moose, you use the phrase Amazon as sort of the Frankenstein of capitalist globalization, the capitalist globalization where, you know, there was a movement that you and I were both part of in the late 90s and early 2000s and onwards that we opposed. And I guess one way of breaking that down is, you know, you have people all over the global south and export processing zones and maquiladoras and sweatshops producing cheap goods, and that is transported as quickly and as fast as possible here, and then Amazon makes sure it gets to customers as quickly as possible, and that also is a reflection of this other part of that Frankenstein, which is surveillance capitalism. You know, people having no rights, people having their lives surveilled in the factories and or in the fulfillment centers. And you were in one of those fulfillment centers for a few weeks, a few months. I forget if it was a few weeks or a few months. And you wrote about this in The Breach, but maybe tell our listeners, give a summary of our listeners of what it's like to work at one of those fulfillment centers, because you had sort of a nuanced view of how Amazon, you know, I guess pays okay relative to other similar kinds of positions, but at the same time has a whole other bunch of things that are just incredible in terms of their insidiousness. So let our listeners know about what it's like to work for Amazon in a fulfillment center.
I mean, I think that, you know, when you work at Amazon, the assumption that, you know, and other journalists have written about this too, and sort of when we think about Amazon, you kind of almost think about a maquiladora or a sweatshop, right? You always have this image that people are just peeing in bottles and people are just collapsing everywhere and sort of this barbaric kind of, you know, capitalist exploitation. And when you begin to work at Amazon, you begin to realize there's a very distinct and unique level of sophistication, right? And you know, Amazon actually treats its warehouses like laboratories, and you don't get that sense until you really work there. And there's both elements, right? So Amazon uses a very sophisticated carrot and stick system, right? So when you work there, when you first even apply, there's no human involved in the application process, right? It's simply done. It's all automated. There's no real interview or real background check. You take some like psychological questionnaire online and kind of show up to a place where you give your photo ID and your SIN number, and they ensure that there's a criminal background check, right? And so when there's no human involved really in the process of hiring, and it's sort of the sophisticated sort of digital, like computerized control, right? And you show up and it's all very like gleamy at the beginning, right? And there's sort of this, what I write about, like the cult of Amazon, right? And so what they really try to enshrine is sort of this loyalty, right? And there's sort of this strategy of the loyal and the weak, right? And so, you know, you show up and everyone's, you know, chipper and wonderfully nice, and there's these free treats, and sort of they gamify things where you take quizzes to win some coupon or a sweater. And there's all about this idea that we're family, right? Which, you know, small employers always used to, you know, sort of employ, you know, sort of, you know, we're family, how can you do this to me? How can you ask for a wage increase? We're family, how can you ask for better work conditions? We're family. And, but a lot of that dropped with sort of this gig work or precarious work where it was just simply survival of the fittest and you're on your own, right? But Amazon sort of reused that strategy to keep everyone in line, right? And so there's always these sort of stand-up meetings every day. And, you know, workers laugh at it, but Amazon really tries to ideologically push it. And it's never about Jeff Bezos, but it's about the customers, right? And so you, we're a family to serve the customers. And also when you arrive, there's sort of two types of Amazon workers, right? You can either be a white badge or a blue badge. White badge is a seasonal temp with the hopes that you'll become permanent. And then if you're a blue badge, you're permanent, right? And what shocked me when I worked there, there was, of course, some degree, refugee claimants, people that, you know, permanent status, but there was a lot of young people too, who were thought this was a stable job. This was a major corporation. They could maybe better themselves, right, by working at Amazon. That a lot of the sort of jobs that exist, you know, there's no real hope that this is going to be a long-term or stable job, right? Because of the way neoliberalism has gutted, you know, any sense of stable work or unionized work. So for a lot of people, Amazon represented sort of the opposite, and it kind of shocked me, you know, and then coupled kind of with the benefits that you get, and they're more meaningful in the US than here. You know, we have, there's still, you know, childcare and, you know, old age security or, you know, still parental leave, you know, but, and so you have all those benefits through Amazon, right? There's a pension plan. There's the possibility of promotions that, you know, and so a lot of workers feel that if you just stick it out in these bad, what they call tier one or level one jobs, you know, where you're a picker or a packer or a stower, that you eventually you'll just move up the ladder, right? You just, or if you're temp, that you'll become permanent and then you'll move up the ladder. So, for me, I think it was a bit of a shock, because when you know, especially for the Immigrant Worker Center, a lot of the people that we work with, that's not the experience, right? A lot of the people that we work with are working through temp agencies, day labor, you know, so there's none of that kind of.
I know that you've supported workers, for example, at the Dollarama warehouse. So maybe that's a useful contrast.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge contrast, right? So at Dollarama, you know, the expectation is just simply that you'll be exploited. If you don't like it, leave, right? Or we can fire you at any point. There's no, you'll be rewarded with promotions or permanent jobs, or you'll be, you know, there's no sense of family. No one cares, right? And there's actually quite the opposite. So a lot of people just feel powerless. They quit. A lot of people just, you know, or they stay because they're in, you know, these, their status is still precarious, right? So they're holding out for better times. And so Dollarama becomes like the quintessential opposite, right? Like they don't care, you know, there's no provision for health and safety equipment. You know, there's no modernization of the warehouse, right? It's just, you know, unabated. Sort of this kind of exploitation, where Amazon, it's the opposite, you know. And but then, so I was like, it was a shock to me, right? And then, but once you start actually working, do you see how it all begins to actually play out, right? And so and the ways that workers complain about across the board, right? And any fulfillment center, right? The kind of you know, that most of your training is spent trying to figure out these, you know, you feel like the Borg at the end of the day, right? Like you strap on some big telephone, what's called a TCI device, that tells you everything that you're going to do. Move this to this block, move this here. And so you begin to realize that you're fully, you know, and then a scanner on your other finger. So everything is fully tracked in the warehouse. You're fully tracked. The box that you touched is fully tracked. Who touched it last? Who touched it after you? And no one tells you your rates, no one tells you what you should be doing. But all of a sudden you realize that everybody else that's not doing this grunt warehouse work is walking around in laptops. And what are they doing? They're watching you on their laptops. And so it creates this kind of stress, because it's not like you can just like wipe your head and put your head on the aisle, because even if no supervisors around, they could be outside smoking and watching you on their computer, right? And one of the other things that gets really sort of Black Mirror-like is that, you know, we were told that the use of artificial intelligence cameras and the way it works inside Amazon is that you're given, they analyze everybody and then, you know, compile that every 6 minutes, right? And then there's a report generated at the end of the day on the 2 meter distance. But it's clear that's not what it's for, right? And that people are just being watched and no one has control over it, right? So even managers would tell you, you know, if you wanna, you know, if you wanna outmaneuver the AI camera, then you gotta duck behind this aisle and try to talk to someone from there, because no one has control over it, right? So you realize that no one's really at the wheel, and it's all this computer programs, right? So everyone tells you that we're family, but at the end of the day, you feel like you're being controlled by like one giant computer. And then it gets more insidious, right? Because it's, you're working, you know, you begin to realize there's a sort of the loyal Amazonian logic, right? Where the shifts are brutal, right? So your shifts begin at 1 a.m. They can finish at noon, which was my case. So it's really hard for people with kids, right? So the way they make it, and this just got corroborated with somebody else's research, was that sort of there's this what they call unregretted rate of attrition, right? It's the Amazon term. Essentially what it means is that there's zero expectation that anyone stays, right? And if anybody stays over a year, they're like the loyal, right? They are the true, strong-willed Amazonians, right? And Amazon has this program, they think they just recently stopped, called the pay-to-quit program, right? Where they paid workers $1,000 a year up to 5 years to leave, right? And the logic was very simple. The logic from the company that they took it from, Zappos, was very different, right? It was to express loyalty, that why would you leave? They were a great company. But for Amazon, it's that, but it's also, you know, Jeff Bezos said it bluntly, if you don't want to be here, you shouldn't be here. And so you entice the loyal to stay and you get the weak to leave on their own, right? And that's Amazon's strategy. So if you look at the US, there's like 150% turnover rate. And here in Canada, it's similar. You know, you talk to workers and they'll say, everybody in my group left. There's just me and like two other people within a year. No one stays at Amazon that long because the work is that brutal, right? And the shifts are that long and the stress of digital control. But on top of that, in this gray zone, like these managers, they feel like they have a lot of power, right? And so it creates this sense, on top of already, then you have these managers who want to express all of this power. So, I mean, I think we're, you know, it's getting to the point where you see workers just being fed up and leaving, which creates kind of challenges for organizing. But, you know, it goes back to your first question, Jaggi. It also says a lot, because if everybody's going to start getting jobs, you know, Amazon becomes more dominant. Amazon's not providing real jobs anymore, right? If no one's going to be able to work at Amazon for longer than a year, what kind of jobs is it providing for society? None, right? And when you look at employers that use a lot of digital technology, you know, right now, like for warehouses, you can't automate a warehouse fully. It's impossible because it's like Tetris, right? And so there's no sophisticated robots that are cheap enough to do that. So it's much cheaper to get humans to do it. And then, you know, to pack these, you know, everyone's packages and get them into these big tote bags, and robots can't do that. But the idea is that a lot of this real-time surveillance is that eventually gets automated, right? So we're going to be posed with the question down the road, what do we do when Amazon actually is shedding jobs, right? And Amazon, but then Amazon is the most dominant way in which we consume goods. So, or right now there's just a brutal turnover, right? So what does that actually mean? And then our governments turn around and subsidize the hell out of Amazon, right? It's insane. And so, working there, it really is like Black Mirror. And like, even when I quit, it was funny, right? So I was Googling around, how do I quit Amazon? And in the US, you can actually quit on your phone, like on an app. In Canada, is you have to call a 1-800 number, right? That's how little they care whether you stay or not, right? Despite all of the we are the family crap that they throw, there's actually no intention that you're staying. And so a lot of the carrots that they throw at people, that they dangle, is just to draw blood from the stone, right? It's just to squeeze you as much as they can until you're broken.
Mustafa, one way to fight back against this is, of course, work organization. And one effective way of work organization is unionization. You spoke earlier about Walmart, and you know, Walmart and Amazon sort of have this parallel history in terms of dealing with unions. Walmart's been virulently anti-union. When a Walmart outlet in the Saguenay here in Quebec was unionized, they just shut down. But you've pointed out that Amazon has an Achilles heel that, you know, means that they just can't do the Walmart strategy of shutting down these, you know, huge fulfillment centers that are near airports or near major transportation hubs. So talk about that before we get into talking about unionization.
Yeah, no, I mean, so that's the problem with fast and free shipping, right? Like, you can't move a warehouse. You can move a factory to Mexico. You can't move a warehouse to Mexico, right? It's virtually impossible, right? Because then you no longer provide Amazon Prime, right? There's no free shipping. There's no fast and free shipping, right? So a lot of what Amazon is relying on is its location, right? So it needs to be within a place that it can, you know, if you look at Amazon's strategy over the years, you know, before warehouses weren't rapid, you know, warehouses, right? Like, you can store things for like 6 months, a year. So they were just needed to be on cheap land near a highway, right? But then with e-commerce and online delivery, you actually need to be closer to these urban populations, right? The further you're away, the slower the delivery becomes, right? And so, there's, you know, what political economists like Anwar Sheikh or Kip Moody have described, capitalists are engaged in like time competition, right? Like, it's about speed. And so once everything becomes about speed, then being close to your market becomes essential, right? So, Amazon, let's take Montreal for example, right? So Amazon's fulfillment centers in Lachine, the delivery stations are in Laval and Lachine. It couldn't be in Trois-Rivières and serve Montreal, right? That would be virtually impossible. So, and everything is also regionally networked, right? Like, the distribution centers here or the fulfillment centers have to serve not just Montreal, but also Ontario and vice versa. There's sort of this regional pattern to Amazon. So they're fixed, right? Like, they're not going to leave. It's not going to be like Walmart. Couche-Tard did the same thing, right? Couche-Tard, when CSN began organizing, just shut down a bunch of Couche-Tards, right? But you're not going to get the same thing with Amazon. It's virtually impossible because it needs to provide next day shipping. And the more you see this in the US, same day or Amazon Prime afternoon or whatever they call it, right? So in places like New York, you can get same day delivery, right? And so Amazon has even had to go further. So they've opened mini warehouses in New York City to meet that process, right? And so, when you look that they need more and more space near these communities. So an example that's not Amazon, but Walmart that I was just reading about, Walmart sees its opportunity to compete with Amazon by using its stores like fulfillment centers, right? Because at Walmart, there's 4,700 Walmarts. So it's even better than Amazon if you think about it that way. So if you just have a bunch of delivery vans outside of each Walmart, you can compete with Amazon like that. And that, so even that Walmart couldn't close the store because Walmart is viewing that as ways to actually do online delivery. So the Achilles heel is that they're stuck. You just can't open up a new fulfillment center. And actually, you know, the amount of money that Amazon invests in these warehouses is quite immense. They're not cheap. You know, like if you look at a fulfillment center, like YUL2 in the Sheen, you know, there's like 500 Kiva robots systems, right? So they're becoming more robotized, right? So, I mean, the only way to evade, I mean, I think I said this somewhere else, is that, you know, let's say in the case of New York, they can't shut down JFK 8 in Staten Island. The best that they can do is, you know, put it on a ship. And Amazon is crazy enough. I mean, don't put it past Amazon. You know, Amazon has patented actually a flying warehouse, right? Like a giant hot air balloon. And that would spit out drones that would deliver things over a city. It's a real patent by Amazon. And so, of course it would evade anything that it could to do so. I think the Achilles heel is quite real for Amazon.
So Mustafa, let's get into the unionization drives. And there's been a lot of attention recently on what happened at JFK 8. Their successful unionization drive. There's been some talk about the unionization efforts here in Montreal. But when you talk about the unionization drive, I'd like you to maybe, you know, compare what happened in Bessemer, Alabama and in New York. They're both fulfillment centers. They both come from different political contexts. One's in Alabama, which I think can fairly be described as not union friendly. And the other is New York City, which can be described relatively speaking as more union friendly. Tell our listeners what are the lessons and what are the important insights that we should take away from these two unionization drives. My understanding is, you know, the JFK 8 one succeeded, but Amazon's going to appeal and there might be some sort of maneuver they make. And in Alabama, they did not succeed the first time, but they're trying again. So give our listeners a sense of what we need to take away from these unionization drives by Amazon workers at fulfillment centers in the United States. And we'll talk later about what's happening here in Montreal.
I mean, it's interesting people to ask that, right? Because there's a lot of debate about what happened in Bessemer, Alabama, right? So, that was a union drive by the retail distribution warehouse workers union, right? And so, eventually they didn't have enough support. They lost the vote. And, you know, in Alabama, the context of Alabama is not just because it's a right to work state. And Bessemer, you know, a place like Amazon is really the large employer, right? It's not just an employer, it's the employer, right? So when you think about these company towns, you know, and that's the context that you have in Alabama. And, you know, I think in the US, Amazon jobs are actually, you know, I'm part of a number of Facebook groups of Amazon workers, you know, it's insidious here and it's insidious there, but a lot of those things are much more meaningful there, right? Like if you look at the thing about in places like Alabama, Amazon provides 20-week parental leave. That doesn't really matter here, right? But in the US, most people get 3 weeks, right? It's a huge jump, right? And there people make 15 an hour. A lot of places pay 10, 9, you know, in the US, it's bad. So, You know, people compare working at Dunkin' Donuts or Amazon and all the time. And, but I mean, the context in December was that it was the major employer. And then, you know, people say, well, the RDSWU just sort of went at it. You know, this traditional union campaign, there wasn't really led by workers. And then workers, and then the union sort of fought back and said, well, you know, we did have meetings in our union hall. We did flyer. There's a lot of critique sort of from the left and back and forth. But I mean, eventually, you know, they pushed it too early and maybe they weren't strong enough in terms of their base of workers, right? And that they didn't have, and they were became reliant upon sort of these, the large celebrities and sort of, you know, Bernie Sanders went, you know, spoke and Biden said you should have a human, all of it didn't matter at the end, right? So in place like New York City and JFK 8, it was very different, right? It was very grassroots, right? And there was no real union involved, right? It was Chris Smalls, who was fired when he tried to hold a walkout in the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, tried to hold a walkout over health and safety conditions. It's by JFK, was fired, and sort of was like, nope, until Amazon is the number one target, right? And was more convinced that, you know, after he was fired, that he had to play a role in improving the conditions of Amazon workers. So it just wasn't him speaking to the media. He began to try to organize a union with his coworkers, right? Or former coworkers, right? Which is an interesting tactic, right? Because Amazon, with the high turnover, how we use former workers is really critical for unions. So a lot of unions will forget them, right? But these are the people that know people on the inside, that still have relationships, can still speak to workers' realities. So in that way, it's not about Chris Smalls, but it's about the idea of him being a former worker that I think was key. And they were a grassroots union, right? So it's really by them, for them. And in New York, you know, a lot of their tactics are similar to what we do at the IWC, right? They just pounded the pavement for almost 2 years, 10 months publicly at a bus stop outside of JFK8, tabling every day, handing out flyers, having, you know, organizing meetings, and then, you know, trying to figure out who to talk to and what department. And when, you know, there was a really great quote, it's when you're trying to organize 8,000 people, which is the size of JFK8, you have no choice but to be public, right? Which is sort of counterintuitive to what a lot of unions think. A lot of unions think you've got to be secret, which is because employers will just fire people, isolate workers, and just crush a union, right? It's like organizing in a dictatorship, right? Organizing a union. So being underground makes sense. But for the ALU, it's like, no, we're going to be public, because when you're dealing with 8,000 people for an election, that's like a political election, right? You can't do it secretly. So they decided to go public. And, you know, a lot of unions would have shunned that. A lot of unions would have shunned the size of JFK, first of all, because the amount of resources would have had to go into organizing it. So, I mean, it was really this grassroots effort of people inside and outside, you know, in terms of just bringing fried rice, in terms of bringing like gun and fried rice and empanadas and trying to meet people where they're at. And they did it every day for 10 months. And then they eventually escalated. They confronted, you know, the managers in these sort of mandatory meetings that they had about the union and anti-union meetings that their managers had. And because they treated like this open political election, they were able to win. Also, it was less slick, to be honest, right? If you look, you know, you look at what happened at December, all of the celebrities, all of the sort of high profile sort of, you know, artists or, you know, politicians who flew in didn't make a difference when these people were just handing out empanadas, right? And you had a bunch of, you know, far left organizers and activists who infiltrated, right? And supported the work of ALU, right? So people from, you know, communist to anarchist to, you know, IWW to the Democratic Socialism of America, you know, all of them went into Amazon with an agenda. We got to be there, be with the people, and sort of help them push ALU. You know, obviously their leadership, but support them. So you had all these elements, which you didn't have at the summer. You know, on top of that, people talk about New York being a sort of a union town as well, and already having a community victory over Amazon, right? And, you know, when they were going to relocate HQ2. So, I mean, New York is different than Alabama contextually, but how the organizing was done. And people say, well, that's unique. But I still think those three elements are actually lessons for us in our organizing. Workplace organizing, or just even outside organizing, right? Like, or organizing in general, right?
Absolutely. And we can add a third jurisdiction to this, which is where you and I both live and organize and work, which is, you know, the island of Montreal. There's a unionization effort here. It's public in the sense that it's been reported, and I've seen stuff on it on social media. But, you know, I guess if we compare Quebec and Montreal to New York and Alabama, we have, relatively speaking, we're more pro-union, I guess, and the laws here are different that might make it easier to unionize. But describe for listeners how that effort is going, because in that case, I believe it's the CSN that's taking the lead, which is one of the major overarching unions, one of the three overarching unions here in Quebec. So in terms of the different strategies, you know, being public versus being secretive up until the point where you're ready to you know, have the vote and sort of surprise the corporation, as well as sort of the, you know, the more of the pound the pavement grassroots approach versus a sort of a more slick approach. Describe for our listeners what the Montreal effort's been like. Where is it and what's been happening?
So in Montreal, you've had, you know, a different kind of organizing campaign, right? That's taking place. And you have the formation now, what's called the Montreal Amazon Workers Union, which is backed by CSN and is focused on YUL2, the fulfillment center here in Lachine. And, you know, workers did approach the CSN in terms of wanting to organize. And what's interesting is that they're, you know, they've been taking the cues from workers. They've gone public fairly early on in May 2022, right? So, or even maybe before May, after what happened in Staten Island, right? And so, you know, leafleting workers on a consistent basis, but also being worker-led, right? And so, and kind of this patience to the organizing, which is interesting as well. And obviously, you know, at Amazon, like the other Amazon fulfillment centers, is that there's a, you know, there's people face lots of issues from immigration related to, you know, health and safety issues. So, and also now Amazon is using the playbook against the union, and, you know, there's stuff now where Amazon is trying to you know, have one-on-one meetings with workers. Amazon's posting about their rights to vote no to a union or to not sign a union card. Amazon is also beginning to try to isolate leaders. So you already have this sort of intensification of what Amazon is doing, right? And so the IWC has been supporting MAWU as well. And so, I mean, the organization efforts here are fairly early on, right? And then there's been the work of, you know, groups like the Immigrant Workers Center, which came out with the Warehouse Workers Commission report in 2019 and trying to fight for better regulations across the entire sector, right? That if Amazon's going to be the dominant model, then you gotta regulate the entire sector, right? And so for us, that's a really big, important issue. And so you do have this organizing taking place, and it's quite early on. Right. And that is, so it's hard to draw any conclusions how it'll go and what kind of strategies are employed, but there's sort of this commitment that it's a worker-led organizing effort, right? And unlike other major unions where you've seen, you know, sort of this outside approach. But the challenges that MAWU face are similar to that in any other Amazon, right? How do you how do you deal with turnover? How do you deal with questions of, of different communities working inside Amazon, right? So there's a lot of these challenges that people will face, and top of it, Amazon's antics, right? And so, but the, you know, for workers, obviously, I think what makes Montreal unique is that technically we have, if you think about it, in North America, we have the strongest unionization law, right? So even though we're not the biggest market for Amazon, right? Not as big as Toronto, there's kind of this it becomes a really important confrontation, right? Maybe unsimilar to sort of JFK8, but nonetheless important, because it'd be harder for them to undo the union, right? And so, it's interesting to see what Amazon will do at this point, because you have union efforts coming from everywhere, right? So you have Teamsters as well, you know, across the board, across North America. You have the Warehouse Workers Center in Brampton, right, in Peel. And then you have, on top of the unions, you have, worker centers who are working with Amazon workers, like us, like the warehouse workers. So there's kind of this moment now where, Amazon thought it had the sort of this tyrannical power to dictate all the terms, but now it's being challenged across so many workplaces, right? And so the Montreal example is interesting because it's a hybrid between a union and support with us. But, and you have that in places like Minneapolis and Shakopee, right? Which is a really fascinating example of Amazon worker resistance, rank and file, right? Multiple walkouts, multiple strikes, not just over the crap work conditions, but over Islamophobia, right? Because it's mostly Somali refugees who work there. So they fought for time off for Eid. They held a walkout on May 1st this year. Walkout, no union, nothing. They walked out. They did the same during Ramadan in 2018, right? Because how can you do 400 items an hour when you've been fasting the whole day? So the models of resistance are plethoric. So we'll see what happens here in terms of the laws that back Amazon workers, but the issues are the same, right? So real health and safety, people are fighting for decent wages, more control over the ways in which promotions actually work within Amazon, because it's a huge issue for everybody in Amazon, not just in Montreal, but everywhere. But Amazon is so bent on not having any union, right? And it's not about the money. It's about the full control, right? And Jeff Bezos said it. So, I mean, it's fascinating, but it's and Amazon is sort of trying to walk this fine line, but it's becoming harder for them to do so, right? And they're going to have to start cracking eggs. And with the backing of the CSN, I think there's a possibility where Amazon's going to have to backtrack a lot.
Can you give our listeners a sense of what are some of those legal advantages we have here in Quebec in terms of union organizing?
So we're the only jurisdictions with car check, right? So which means that a lot of places you have to have these mandatory elections, right? And then you have to reach a certain threshold to even have an election to form a union. So in Quebec, you can form a union simply by more than half of a workplace, sign a union card, and then that's it. That rarely exists. So it makes it much easier to form a union, right? And gives less power to the employers to try to stop it. The language around retaliation by an employer is much stronger here than it is in other places, right? So there's more laws that prohibit what an employer can do during an election campaign, right? Within the labor code. So it's much more restrictive for employers, right? And because it's considered really a fundamental right here. So those two aspects make it much easier to form a union, right? And there's also that kind of a different political culture as well around unions.
You've spoken or you've talked about in previous interviews about how sometimes, you know, unions are at counter purposes. I mean, this is not surprising. Unions are often rivals of each other. And, you know, when I'm hearing about you describe, you know, these efforts and, you know, people just organizing themselves, what have you, one question that could be asked is, why has it taken so long to get to the point where one can unionize, especially, say, in a jurisdiction like Quebec or other jurisdictions that are generally or relatively favorable to unionization efforts than so-called right-to-work states? And you've also drawn the contrast of how corporations, on the other hand, often collaborate. A classic example would be how Amazon backed up Uber when there was a referendum in California on whether Uber drivers would be recognized with full labor rights as workers and not just as temp people. So how is that being overcome? And is that, you know, you've given some of the positive examples, I guess, of you know, nitty-gritty organizing that works or that's at least in the right direction, such as an ex-worker like Chris Smalls and others, just, you know, pounding the pavement and being patient and flyering to, you know, to having the patience to use the laws in your favor and get unionized. But there seems to be also some constraints. So talk about that. And is the rivalry between unions actually our Achilles heel, so to speak, in terms of leveraging our power, worker power, against a corporation like Amazon?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is, right? Like, obviously, there's different politics, right? And there's like different between the unions, right? But to think about things, you know, and not simply about your own membership and what will you get out of your organizing drive, but to think about something bigger and broader, right? And that, you know, this is a company that has a nominal GDP bigger than Canada, right? You know, unions think they have like really limitless resources, and we on the left, radical left, we look at unions, we're like, oh my God, look at all the money they have, and they don't know what to do with it efficiently. We could have a revolution, you know, with these kinds of resources, right? But compare that to what Amazon has, it's a bit minuscule, right? No, the idea that, like, you know, that you're going to just get, you know, you're going to like whatever workers you're going to get for your union, and thinking about just simply your membership and, you know, your immediate goals at the expense of the broader goals of the labor movement, it's going to come back to haunt you, right? Because Amazon is going to win that way. And, you know, we've seen that now with Uber and the deal with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, you know, stomping over grassroots efforts like the Gig Workers United. And with Amazon, it's such a big fish that no one union can take it on, right? So there has to be a larger sense of, no, we're actually in coalition together, right? This is about the entire working class. This is about immigrants and migrants. This is about women. This is about how we eat, how we consume goods. This is about labor in the global south. This is about, you know, everything. And so if we don't work together to challenge it, then they're just going to divide and conquer, right? And in terms of, let's say, even when unions just think about their own immediate interests, let's say organize, right? Isn't it much easier if people met and it was like, well, we'll organize a delivery station. You organize the fulfillment centers. We'll take on the, what they call the flex drivers, right? And this way, you know, if there's an actual real strategy and plan. But I think part of the problem is that also means a left within the union that can actually, you know, put forward that kind of position or fight for it inside the union, right? And so, I mean, this is a really big challenge. And then, you know, I think a lot of them probably feel threatened, or there's this crisis moment too, because they're looking at what happened at JFK 8 for a fraction of the money, right? You know, because the logic, unfortunately, is that even if it's not done in a bad light, unions will say, well, we're accountable to our members. And our members will say, why are you spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on an unsuccessful union campaign when we deserve to be served? We're paying the dues, right? But this rank and file effort showed that it is possible on a much smaller, you know, budget, you know, and a much bigger, large scale union drive. But it takes commitment. And so the rivalry between union is really about this way that's thinking that's so narrow minded and short term, that it's not gonna help even for their own membership, even out of their own immediate interest, right? So instead of having some kind of strategic outlook that's much bigger and grander, which would then allow for the strategies to really even defend their own members' interests.
Mustafa Hanawe, a labor organizer with the Immigrant Workers Center, thank you so much for sharing your insights on No Borders Media and No One's Legal Radio. Definitely, I'm sure we're going to, I mean, there's so much to pick through from just from your last reply there about these discussions and that we need to be having and the lack of that on the radical left. But I guess in our own modest ways, we're doing that right now. And we'll surely continue that in the future. Again, Moose, thanks for taking the time.
No, thank you so much, Jaggy, and thank you so much for having me on No One Is Legal Radio and No Borders Media. But also, yeah, I mean, again, in that modest way, bringing that effort and even the fact that we're talking about Amazon in the context of No One Is Illegal Radio, right, is like pushing forward that analysis and that kind of framework.
Absolutely. And we've always, including in our promo, have talked about, you know, this being a show about working class people of color. So, you know, as you pointed out, you know, Amazon has a majority black workforce. You talked about the Najawan support network that I've been following in the GTA area, which is mainly Punjabi folks, or that scandalous stuff that happened here in the Montreal area around these schools that shut down. So absolutely, there's a lot that we need to pick through, and I hope to do so again really soon. Thanks again, Moose.
Thank you again, Jaggy, and thanks everybody on No One Is Legal Radio listening.
That wraps up the June 2022 edition of No One's Legal Radio. No One's Legal Radio is part of No Borders Media and the CKUT Communist Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. No One's Legal Radio highlights the struggles of communities in resistance with a focus on the self-determination struggles of Indigenous peoples, migrants, refugees, and working class people of color. Stay tuned for Upstage.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. The show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal. Also known as Jojage in Ganiagahaga and Muniang in Anishinaabe. Where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah Day, recording from home on Thursday, June 2nd, 2022. On tonight's show, my guests, meet Martine Donneveld, one of the new co-artistic directors of Festival Transamérique, as the FTA marks its 16th edition.
It's a dream job, really. It's like, FTA is very well known outside Montreal, Quebec, Canada. Jesse Mill and our predecessor, Martin Fauché, and the founder of the festival, Marie-Hélène Falcon, have been traveling widely, you know, all throughout their professional lives. So me being in Europe, I saw them come to our festivals, and everybody knows that FTA is a wonderful place to work.
Actress and writer Miriam Cummings spins a fairy tale about dating, inspired by her grandparents' own love story.
This text is a direct transcription of life interviews I did with my granny as part of a project when I was studying theater at Concordia. And my granny was a beautiful